You want to announce something?
Yes, if that's okay.
I'm probably going to be a minute or two longer, so wait a minute. Yeah, do it.
Okay, guys, tonight Comstock is having their annual general meeting at 6 p.m. on the fourth floor, and they're voting in the committee members for next year.
Yeah.
And a couple of
first
years are running for positions, so if you want to come along tonight at 6 p.m., fourth floor, and vote for them, that'd be great.
Cool. Thank you.
Do we have any of the candidates here? Yeah, do you want to make a speech? Tell us about yourself. Okay. Okay. Is Comstock doing anything other than voting this evening? Is it actually a meeting? Anyone know? Right, so they might, okay, that's fine. You could advertise that as well. Queries over for information retrieval. So we've had, last time we had lots about information retrieval, which is if you have a big batch of documents and you want to find out which ones might be relevant to your query, but you don't want to give too complicated a query and you don't want to have a system return hundreds of documents which might be relevant that you then have to go through. And there's a question of trade-off of precision and recall. You want to get back documents that are relevant, but you don't want to miss ones. By being too precise, you don't want to miss ones that might be relevant. And this is really all how to operate under a system which is not completely reliable, where you don't have all the information you'd like, and a commuter's going to have to do some guessing here, but can we manage with that? And as you saw in the demo of Watson, that's doing a lot of things by guessing, actually. Lots of its algorithms are imprecise, or they work 90% of the time, which is pretty good. And so how can you manage with that? And maybe if you've got two algorithms that work okay 70% of the time, and the algorithms come with confidence at, say, the times when they think they're successful and when they don't, when they're unsure, you can combine those to get more precise algorithms. So there's a lot of working with imprecise data and imprecise information here. And so we've had the issue of, well, if it's imprecise, how do we know how imprecise it is? What measures are we trying to improve? Trade-off between precision and recall. The fact you can't necessarily have both, but it may be that in certain situations, one is more important than the other. And that was all about assessing such a system. How would you see if it was the system you wanted? How would you evaluate the results it produces? But we now have to think about, well, okay, so we got our idea of what would be good enough and what we'd be interested in and how we could evaluate a system if we had one. How can we build such a thing? And I'm not really going to talk about detailed implementation and efficient implementation over large data sets, big collections of documents spread among a whole racks full of machines. This is about, well, before we start implementing the algorithm, we have to decide what is it we wanted to do. We decided how we'd know if we got it right. We now want to think, well, what is the thing that we might need to assess whether it's right or not? And the sort of queries we're going to look at are fairly simple queries. Information retrieval systems do work over enormously elaborate and complex queries. In the corpora query system that you used in the tutorial, one could build quite elaborate queries out of regular expressions and logical combinations and words that look like this that are next to parts of speech like that, but not after parts of speech like the other, and so on. We're going to look at much simpler queries that are just some words. And the query is find some documents containing these words. And we might say find a document containing all of those words. We might be interested in documents that contain some of them. We might have more complex combinations. But really, we're just going to look at saying, we're interested in these documents. We want to find the documents containing these five words or whatever. And historically, information retrieval systems have gone for much more complex kind of queries, elaborate query languages where you can state exactly what you want, the thing you're mostly interested in, some secondary terms that might be relevant, and so on. And these were made richer and richer in the hope that if you got people to specify more precisely what it was they wanted, then you could write a system that would really return just that. And it turns out that while there are two problems with this, one is it's quite hard to write the algorithms to take into account these complex queries and to get metadata or additional information about the document where these kind of subterms and things can make a difference. And the other problem is people aren't very interested in writing complex queries. Or if they do start writing them in your complex query system, they might use it in ways you didn't expect, and so it doesn't match the algorithm you wrote. So in fact, much, much more progress recently has been made in these very simple query systems, the prime example of which is web search engines. Back when web search engines started to be developed, they kind of went two ways. You had the ones that just said, give me some words and we'll see what we can find, and that's typified by the successful ones now. And there were some richer ones that said, well, give me some words and some additional information. Use your expertise in the field to phrase a query in such a way that we can give you a really pinpoint answer. And in niche vertical fields where you know exactly what you're looking for, maybe library systems, that begins to work. But a lot of the time, people are just really, really happy with simple queries like this. And if you can get performance good enough, if you can get the recall and precision reasonably decent, then that's enough. So it looks like it's a very simple kind of query, but it's actually extremely successful, and it's something that people feel very happy with on the whole. Okay, so we're going to look just at simple queries of a collection of words, and we're looking at all documents that contain all words of the query. Well, or maybe just some words of the query. That's going to result in an awful lot of documents, actually. Typically, with a large document set, everything in a library, the whole history of a newspaper, something like that, all the web. Just saying, I want all the documents with the words in, is going to give you back too many. So you begin to say, well, can we rank them? Can we say which ones are most likely to be most relevant to our query? So actually, you're doing two kinds of assessment there. One is, what's this document about? And the other is, what's this query about, really? You know, given the words that the person chose to use in the query, what is it they're really asking for, and which documents match that? And that's, so you need, as well as a selection system for information retrieval, you want a ranking system. And again, there's a trade-off. If you have a selection system that's not that great, it tends to give far too many documents, but a ranking system that is excellent and really puts the best ones up the top, then you can leave it up to the person using it to get see how far down the list they're interested in going. That's essentially what Google does when it says, oh, we returned 100,000 pages about this. Nobody ever looks at the 100,000th page. In fact, turns out that quite a lot of the time, they've fixed this up now, but for a long time, you'd get this page where you search for Google and it says, these are the first 10 of 8 million results we have on this. And actually, they didn't have 8 million results. They had maybe 15. But as long as nobody ever clicked to the next page, you never found out. And there was a particular domain in which this was absolutely extreme. They would suggest that they had all the pages on the web that were relevant, that all the pages on the web were irrelevant. But actually, when you looked down the thing, you could only get a couple of pages before it dried up. So they fixed that to an extent. But it's an illustration of how, actually, it wasn't so much the selection there, but the ranking that was a really, really important thing. So it's one of those trade-offs. You can have something that has, if it's got good recall but terrible precision, that's because it returns all of the documents you want and a whole bunch of other stuff aside. If you can then rank, maybe that's not a problem. If, on the other hand, fetching the documents to inspect whether they're what you're interested in is really expensive, you might want to only return a few in the first place. Okay, so we're going to look at one such ranking method. But ranking methods are really, really important. And finding more and more sophisticated ranking methods is a big area of endeavor, partly because it depends on understanding the query as much as it does the documents, particularly if you get... So Watson, remember, was doing taking kind of questions. It wasn't just a random sample of words. The game show had questions in a particular format. And it's the same with general questioning answering systems. You're asking a question of a machine, and as well as the words you're using, there might be more subtle cues in there that it could use to help with the ranking algorithm. So the ranking algorithm we're going to look at is based on the vector space model. Vector space model is one that represents documents as vectors in a high-dimensional vector space. It's the basis of an awful lot of information retrieval applications, and it dates back to the 70s, where it was being developed, and a guy called Gerald Salter and a number of other people with him, but he was the leading light kind of pushing this through when there were lots of different competing models, and he was seen as, you know, it's one of a niche, and it turned out to be really rather successful, but it was seen as slightly out there in terms of the mass it required. And it's still actively developed. People refine it and reuse it for other things. We're going to use it just in a fairly simple example, but it has a whole bunch of theory built on top of it. There is an interesting information retrieval story attached to this vector space model, which I'll refer to when I've actually said what the model is. Okay, so the core idea is that we treat documents as points in a vector space. It's not necessary to understand a lot about higher dimensional vector spaces for this to work. The algorithm, you could still turn the handle and do it works. But the idea is that we have, supposing we have three-dimensional vector space, Cartesian R3, and one can have a vector, if you're given three numbers, three coordinates, x, y, and z, that defines a point in that space, more generally it defines a vector from the origin to a particular point. So that's a vector in space. And for any three values, any three real numbers, you get a point in space, and for any point in space, you get three numbers. And you can if you have a document and you count the number of occurrences of three words in that document, so you've got three words, of, the, and but, say, you count the number of times they occur. If this is the of axis, this is the axis, this is the but axis. Actually, that's not particularly... So from the Dickens one, supposing we had Mr. Bumble goes to church. So these are words that occur in the Dickens corpus. And if you take a particular work of Dickens or a chapter and you look for the occurrences of Mr., there'll probably be quite a lot because it's very formal. Bumble, he doesn't occur in all of them. And church, which occurs in several of them. You'll get a count. You'll get a number of times Mr. occurs, number of times Bumble occurs, number of times church occurs. And that gives you a point. And so you can represent that document by that point in the space. And two different documents you can represent by two different points. And that's the underlying idea for the vector space model. Now, of course, we're generally interested in more than three words in the document, and documents generally contain more than three words. So the full generality is that we consider a higher dimensional vector space. Well, we have any number of dimensions here, which obviously don't fit on the board, but then neither did three dimensions, and you didn't complain too much about that. So we have a very, very high number of dimensions, and any document is represented by a point in that high dimensional space, or in general, a vector from the origin to that point. And what we're going to look at is how documents are similar, or how they're similar to a query, by the geometric properties of those vectors and those points in space. We've got this mathematical model of points in space, and we can do things with it. We can see, are they clustered together? Are they nearby? Are they far apart? And so on and so forth. And this in general is a very powerful technique, but something that's quite hard to get your head around in almost any field. You can take something that doesn't look like it's particularly mathematical or it doesn't look like it's particularly geometric. It's something to do with words or speech or some very real-world data. And then you can turn it into a vector space, perhaps in lots and lots of dimensions, and suddenly you have a geometric handle on it. You can use things, algorithms like, can we find the volume something contains, or can we find a surface enclosing it? And it turns out, and then you look up in the book, what's the algorithm for doing that, how do you compute it, and plug it in, and you get something that's meaningful back in the original domain. So in this case, similarity between documents can be related to similarity between vectors or clustering of points. So the fact that this is happening in some insanely high-dimensional vector space doesn't really need you to visualize that. It's enough to visualize points in three-dimensional space. And then what we do is we mark the query in the same space. We say the query, which again is a small document containing a number of words. We draw the vector for the query, which concerns which words appear in the query, and then see which of the document vectors this query vector is closest to. And that's used for the ranking. So this vector space model, this idea of representing a document as a point in a high-dimensional vector space, which is due to this guy, Salter. So if you're working in this field, the vector space model of VSM, then and you're writing a paper about it, you need to cite where the VSM model comes from. And so you cite the one that people will write the paper they last read that they're basing this work on, some earlier ones, and of course you have to cite an original paper that describes the vector space model, and typically they cite a particular paper by Salter and some others from 1975 with a title about a vector space model for document retrieval or something like that. And the really interesting thing about this is this document doesn't exist, but it's a persistent bibliographic reference. People copy it from other papers about vector space models. They say, oh, we need a base reference of the vector space model. I'll use this one they did and copy it across. Cut and paste it in, and never, ever try and read it. And anyway, it's from 1975, and who can find anything that was published in 1975? You'd have to, like, actually go and look in a book or something else. So people just continually refer to it. It's kind of interesting for two reasons. One is a shallow reason, one is a deep reason. The shallow reason is just funny. And it's very hard to make it go away, because once it's out there, all kinds of automatic retrieval engines, things like Google Scholar and Citesear, engines that will run over scientific papers and look for how they're connected, which papers cite which other papers, what the titles are, which authors are most published, and so forth. They will use clues about the existence of a paper, including the references somewhere else, to infer the existence of papers that it can't directly find. And so search engines that work over scientific papers, after doing their document analysis, may decide that this paper really exists and start to look at its properties, you know, how popular it is, when it was most popular, what happened to the people who wrote it, and so forth. Even though the thing doesn't exist, you have this kind of ghost piece of information. And that's just one of the things you get with these imprecise things. You have a system that's, most of the time, it's giving you a right answer, so it's good enough to go with, but you have to be aware that it's not always going to be based on totally reliable data. So that's the shallow reason, it's just kind of amusing. The slightly deeper one is that Salter did write publish papers about this time, which, not with the title everybody cites, which deal with the vector space model or particular applications of it, but absolutely not in the generality that I just described. It's saying, oh, we think of a document as a point in space, and then we do geometric things to that vector space. It was much more they had individual applications with a particular algorithm. They could say, we do this, and we do this, and we do this. And it was only just coming together that this was a general way of looking at things. And then later, once people had the general way of looking at things, they just retroactively interpreted everything people had said before and said, oh, yes, this was obviously an instance of that or that or that. Though, in fact, the general concept wasn't around. And that happens a lot in scientific developments or in computer science or maths as much as anything else. Things get to a point where there's a visualization or representation that we can teach to you and say it's like this. But it actually may have come out of years and years of work when people are using this but didn't quite understand the general model. It just had individual instances. So although people cite 1975 and the mid-70s as the start of the vector space model, it wasn't really there until about the 80s, as seen as this is one model of which these are all just individual applications. It's also to do with kind of selling people on this. People might say, you want to use 5,000 dimensional vector spaces to deal with this document, I think that's a bit hard. But if you give them an algorithm and say, build an array, calculate this, get the answer, and it shows that it gives results, people will be reasonably happy with that. And only when the algorithm has worked a lot do you say, well, really, it's because of this high-dimensional vector space. Okay, so the vector associated to a document is, you have a document and, okay, for, so term one to term n, these are all the words that occur in all of these K documents. So together we have a large number of documents and an enormous number of words. And each document gets a vector, which is just a series of values, which is the count of each word, how often how often any particular word occurs in that document. So we get, if we have document A, that's represented by a vector A1, A2, all the way up to AN, where N is the total number of words that appear in any of the documents. So if a word doesn't appear, it'll be zero. If it appears five times, the value will be five, and so on. And we treat that as a vector. In various programming languages, that's actually called a vector. It's just a fixed length list of values. The order is important because this refers to a particular word, and that refers to a particular word. And the fact it's a fixed length is also important. Notice we've lost some information here. You could conceivably have two documents represented by the same vector just because they happen to contain exactly the same number of words of every kind, but just in a different order. And surprisingly often, that changes the meaning. Perhaps surprisingly often, that doesn't change the meaning. You can get a remarkable amount out of a document, such as what it's likely to be about and the attitude it's likely to be taking, from just the count of the words, irrespective of the order they come in. So in one sense, we're throwing away an insane amount of information about a document. But actually, we get enough left to make reasonable queries anyway. And we have another document, say, B, E1, E2, to BN. And we have our query, Q, and we can treat that as a very small document as well, Q1, Q2, to QN. And it's quite likely that the typical query will actually have zeros almost everywhere because it'll just refer to a few words, and a typical document will have most of these be non-zero. But anyway, they're all vectors. So we've got a vector A, vector B, and another vector Q. They're all vectors in some higher dimensional space. And so here's an example. This is an extremely short document. Sun, here it comes. Supposing you have a collection of documents that, curiously, only consist of the word sun, here it comes. And then, again, fits on a slide. So for this document, sun, here it comes, the vector is 1, 1, 1, 3. So that's a particular point in four-dimensional space. We've lost the information about the order they're in, but it doesn't matter. And if we want to make a query, sun comes, then 1, 0, 0, 1 will be the appropriate vector. So we have two vectors, one representing the query, one representing the document. And the idea is that what we'll do is we'll measure the similarity by looking at which angles, which document is closest to the original query. We're going to measure the angle, theta, which that's theta B and theta A, the angle between the query and the document vector. Measuring the angle means it doesn't matter how long the vector is. So a short query, which will typically be represented by quite a short vector, and a long vector for the document, will actually, we'll just look at the angle between them. And a very small angle will mean that we think that the document closely matches the query, and a very large angle means we think the document and the query have very little to do with one another. You can also measure similarity between documents using this. If two large documents, their vectors point in very much the same direction, that means that the documents have a lot in common with each other. This is one of the kind of things Turnitin or plagiarism checkers will do, is look for this kind of similarity. They tend to care a lot about the order, though, because they're looking for people cutting and pasting exact sentences. So we have one vector for each document, lots and lots of documents. This gives us a matrix, a grid, where the columns represent the words and the rows represent each document. So here I represented initially as the rows showing for each document these are the words that appear in, but you could also look at it the other way around. You say, for this word, might be the, this is the number of times it occurs in each of the documents and in the query. So here's an example. We have term one to term n, all the possible all the possible words in the document, all the documents, and then a grid that where every cell represents the number of times a particular word occurs in a particular document. If you look at the rows, then you get the individual documents. If you look at the columns, you get the occurrences of the terms. And this is the kind of statistical data that you could extract from a document using something like the query processing tool that you had in the tutorials. And obviously, you can automate this. Yeah?
For example, if I had a query which mentions some 100 times and more query, the document, and my query originally was about sun and moon, and somehow I feel that this angle should be different, like, it should be quite large angle.
It, there will be, yeah, so in fact...
So it's not the document I'm looking for.
It will have a different angle because the number of times it occurs affects the angle. If we just look at two dimensions, then... Supposing we're only looking at sun and moon, okay, and you're looking for occurrences of the word the sun, so the query vector is here, then a document that mentioned the moon five times and the sun once would be up here, and a document that mentioned the moon five times and the sun 1,000 times would be way over here, and so would a line. So even though both of them actually are, you know, this is very different to that because it's a lot longer. And it does contain, this contains as many, if I've brought far enough it will. This contains as many occurrences of moon as this one, but all of the sun references have tilted it around until the angle is quite small.
And if I'm looking for a report together of sun and moon, then...
Okay, then you'd end up here. And that would probably be closer to the one that had one sun and five moons because they're more in balance. Whereas the one that has five moons and 1,000 suns, it will be different. It would be probably slightly further away from because it would be very flat. So in fact, the angles that are coming here are, although I'm drawing them as though we have vectors pointing away from one another in a space, in a plane, for these documents, really the distance comes because you have a fantastically large number of dimensions. And so things can be quite different, quite almost at right angles, because they essentially mention completely different sets of words. Or close together if they mention more words. And there is a weighting in here that if you've got two documents that contain the word you're looking for, supposing I'm looking for the word moon, then both documents contain five occurrences of the word moon. But in one of them, they're completely swamped by the occurrences of sun. And so you'll get the one where moon plays a higher proportion of the words. So it captures some, but not all, of the intuitions you might have about matching things. The real thing is that this takes an idea of generally want the words to be the same and makes it work for very large numbers of words and also for when they're different, where the query is short and the document is long, but you can just use the same representation for both. This is also a slightly unexpected step to say, I'll consider the query and the document as the same kind of thing and then just look for similarities, rather than saying the query is in some way special. This can give algorithmic advantages. If you find a very quick way of doing this comparison, then you can just throw the query and the document at it equally. So we want to rank documents according to their relevance to the query. We do it by defining some similarity between the vectors, and the idea is that documents that are most similar to the query vector are the documents we're interested in. And also, we don't just have to pick the best. If we have 10,000 documents returned as being potentially relevant, then we can order them by their angle to the query and present the first 50 and then let the user start choosing at that point. And there's lots of research on what's the interesting number to present. Will people ever look past the fifth entry, or in some specialized domains will they look past the 10th or 20th? There are lots and lots of kinds of similarity measures, but the one that gets you kind of the most return for the simplest computation is looking at the angle between the vectors, or more specifically the cosine of the angle, because that's easier to compute and it has the same ranking properties. If one angle is larger than another, then the cosine will be smaller. Okay, this is high school maths. The cosine of angle, if you have a right angle triangle, we have an angle, traditionally regarded as theta, and a right angle triangle, and this is referred to as the adjacent edge, this is the opposite, this is the hypotenuse, and the cosine is the adjacent over the hypotenuse. So it ranges between 0 and 1, provided the angle is between 0 and 90. The angle gets bigger, then it takes negative values. The cosine of 0, angle 0 is 1, the cosine of 90 degrees is 0, the cosine of 180 degrees is minus 1. The graph looks something like this. And cosine always lies between 1 and minus 1. And what we want to do is measure the angle between the graphs by finding their vectors by finding their cosine. And it turns out that there's a standard way to do this using the scalar product. We have two vectors. This is one document, this is another. Or this is one document, this is a query. Then the way to compute... the cosine is to take a sum of products. So supposing we want to find the cosine of the angle between B and the query, then and call that angle theta, then it turns out that if we take these in pairs and multiply them together, so the counts for each word, so B1 Q1 plus B2 Q2 plus all the way up to Bn Qn, that's known as the dot product of the two vectors, B dot Q, or scalar product. That's equal, so if these are two vectors, I would have the angle between them, that's equal to the length of the vector B times the length of the vector Q. So typically Q will be quite a short vector and that B will be a long vector, multiplied by the cosine of the angle between them. And one can compute that. Essentially what's happening is that we've worked out the area of this diamond in between them. And the area of the diamond is can also be calculated by looking at the base times the height. And the height, cosine, yeah, so the height is, that doesn't work. I'll take that back. Ignore me. I may have to do that again at the end. So it's B times Q times cos theta, but we can calculate the length of the vectors by Pythagoras, even in high dimensions. So the length of B is the square root of B1 squared plus B2 squared plus all the way up to Bn squared. And similarly for the length of Q. So we can then, the cosine of the angle, and that's what I've done here, is the sum of the products divided by the product of the square root of the sums of the squares. So it's just a routine calculation. Now, if you're doing it in two dimensions, you could work this out by hand and do the geometry and see what's happening. If you do it three, you might be able to. We're doing it in some enormous number of dimensions, one for every word, kind of word in the document, but that doesn't matter. The computations are the same. It's also not particularly, slow to compute. You have to recompute it for every query in every document. You can pre-compute the lengths of the vectors. This square here of x doesn't depend on y, so you can compute the lengths of vectors of the document, and you can do some other optimizations. But it's not a tremendously complex calculation to do. And this gives you the cosine of the angle between them. And if the cosine is close to 1, that means that the two documents are very near together. If the cosine is further down here, that means the documents are increasingly far apart. So if the cosine is 0, that means that your two vectors are at right angles. The document mentions none of the words that are in the query, and you're not interested in it. If they align exactly, if the angle is 0, that means the document mentions only the words in the query, and you're very interested indeed in it. In fact, you're rather surprised to find a document comprising only the words of your query. So the if a small cosine means a good match. So here's an example. This is the sun, here it comes example. That was the vector for the document. That's the vector for the query. The scalar product is 4. If I multiply them pairwise, 1 times 1 plus 1 times 0 plus 1 times 0 plus 3 times 1 is 4. The lengths of the vectors, the document here, vector has length root 12. The query vector has length root 2. I square all the components and add them up. And then, so the cosine of it is 0.82. And so that's reasonably high. So you might say, well, that's quite a good match. We're in this part of the graph. But of course, if you're drawing from a collection of documents, the question is not, is 0.82 a large value? It's, is it larger than the other ones that we've got? Do we have other ones even higher? Because all of these documents were taken from a remarkably small lexicon, only 4 words, it's quite likely that any query matches any document reasonably well. So it becomes most interesting when you have a whole collection of documents. So we calculate, we've got k documents over n different words in the dictionary. We calculate the k cosine values, and then the ones with the highest cosine value, those are the ones we regard as the best match. And the ones with the lowest cosine values, those are least suitable. So it becomes quite a simple thing. Say, here's a vector representing a document. I can do a single computation to get the rank of it. Again, I compare the document with the query, and I use that to rank it. So it's better than we started with, because at the start of the lecture, we didn't have any way to measure documents at all. We just had a way to assess algorithms that would tell us about the documents. So that's good. It's good in that it can apply to documents with large documents, small documents equally. The size of the document will affect the size of that vector, but not the direction it's pointing in. So it won't be biased towards large documents. A large document, remember, might hit lots of query words just because it has lots of words in it, but still will not be very interesting. This angle will take account of what proportion of the words are the query words that we're interested in. And that's good. It has this uniformity in that it treats the query and the document on a par with one another. So one thing that means is it can also look for, it can work over comparatively large queries. You can write a query by just saying, these are the three words I'm interested in, which is how you type it into Google, say. But another kind of query is, say, take this paragraph of existing text and find documents that are on the same kind of subject. So that's potentially quite a large query, but we can use exactly the same mechanism. We take the vector for the paragraph and compare it to the vector for documents. You can use it for things like, are these two documents likely to be by the same author? They're using similar lexicons or different ones. And of all of these documents, are they generally by the same? How many authors are there involved? If you take all of the vectors and try and cluster them by the angles of difference, you may find they're all in one cluster, or they're in three distinct clusters, which would suggest three different authors. But it's also really, really, really crude. It's not taking into account what order the words come in, how they're used, even what part of speech they're being used as when they appear. Remember, you can have the same word that occurs both as a noun or a verb or an adjective in different settings. So we've lost lots and lots of information about the documents. We're not using any information about where the documents came from or how they're connected together. We're including, so standardly, this would include punctuation, maybe, but also so-called stop words, the and a and, which you probably don't put in your query, and they shouldn't really count towards it in the document, but somehow they will be weighting the direction of the vector. Actually, although the cosine measure takes all of those words into account, even the stop words, it's quite reasonably self-correcting in that those won't affect the outcome of the query very much, unless your document consists of an enormously large number of A's and B's and A's, which again makes it a rather distinctive kind of document. All words in the document collection are weighted equally. We've used nothing about the semantic information, what the words mean, whether the words in the query are distinctive in some way. So you may have a word that is really, really distinct. So for example, if you're looking in news articles for discussion of a particular an earthquake in a particular country, then the words earthquake or city or disaster, those are reasonably common words, but the name of the country is extremely distinctive. And it's quite likely if you look for a query that says earthquake Chile 1970s or something, then you're looking for earthquakes in Chile in the 1970s. But this kind of mechanism will treat them all as exactly equal, even though some words, proper nouns, for example, are distinctive and probably likely to play an important part in the query and in the document. So that's a refined to this stop word instance. There are some words we can say, ignore that in the query, it won't help, that's in every document. And equally, there are some words that, by their meaning, we might think are more significant, and this takes no account of that. And also, we ignore document size. Actually, I don't think that's so much of a problem, unless you're saying, I want documents of a particular dimension. But there will be some effect whereby large documents, really, really large documents, might swamp smaller documents just because the large documents hit many more words by chance, as it were. But each of those issues, as soon as you raise it, you can start to think about, well, how can we adjust the query, the search to take account of that? So for stop words, we could just strip out all of the occurrences of a and the and but from our document. Taking word position and ordering, we can maybe look for bigrams, or we can put certain weights on this kind of thing. So as soon as you mention a possible problem with it, you can think, well, how could I adapt the algorithm to improve that? And moreover, because we have things like measures of precision and recall, we have ways to evaluate these algorithms. You could take some search or some document retrieval task and try it with just the cosine matching or with your cosine plus removal of stop words and word weighting algorithm. And this is what people do a lot. They say, the document retrieval algorithm is clearly flawed because it doesn't take account of this. You think of some way to try and take account of it, and then you run it on the old queries that you had before and see if things are any better. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. this is very much an empirical activity. If you're looking for people's real queries over real document sets, then you may think that the reason it's performing badly is because it doesn't take sufficient account of the weights of particular kinds of words or the importance of certain words. And you may find if you put that information into the algorithm, actually it doesn't get any better at all. So although you might observe document retrieval systems improving progressively, that's only because people are trying lots and lots and lots of different ideas and then throwing away the ones that don't work. It's absolutely not the case that these things, if you fix them, things will get better. You have to try and see. Okay, so there is an issue with the evaluation. I talked about evaluating precision and recall, and that doesn't really take account into ranking. That's just assuming that the task is to retrieve some documents. Did you get the right ones? If what's happening, if you're saying, well, I'm getting lots of them, but I'm able to rank them so you can cope with more of them, then you need other kinds of evaluation methods. You can talk about precision at a cutoff. You'll have a long list of documents, but you're only interested in the first N. Or maybe you have a system that produces a number of documents and tags them all with a confidence that says, I'm highly confident this is related to the query. I'm less confident so on. The confidence might be derived from this cosine measure, in fact. And you might say, well, the precision at a cutoff would be, give me back all the documents, and I'll look for the ones, I'll see how many there are you're 90% confident about, and then we'll evaluate those. For more sophisticated algorithms, you might begin to want to say more refined kinds of evaluation. For document selection, for example, looking for newspaper articles, it's enough to return half a dozen. For question answering, where you want to ask the machine, what is the capital of Ukraine, for example, then you just want the answer. You don't want eight documents which may include the information about the capital of Ukraine. You want the answer. And this is what the Watson system did. It was taking lots of documents, but it wasn't returning lots of documents. It was returning the answer to a particular query. And again, there you need different kind of evaluation methods, not how many of the answers were correct. You just want the one. Was it right? Or was it good enough? I've not talked at all about efficient implementation, how you actually find the documents. If the documents are out there on disk or some array of disks, then how do we construct these cosine measures? How do we check them? And almost certainly what we don't do is go to the document and compute the vector, take the query, do this computation, and return the answer, and then go and get the next document. That will take a long, long time. And remember, the cosine query method is throwing away a lot of information about the document. And every time it consults the documents, it's throwing away the same information. So we could cache that. We could pre-compute the vectors and put them beside the document. We could also use an inverted index. Typically, a document, you have a list of words. One could arrange that as a table that said, or relational database said, for each position, what word appears at that position. It's a rather boring table, but that's one way of representing the document. You can clearly retrieve the document from it. You could then invert that table and say, for each word, at what positions does it appear? And that's quite computationally expensive to produce from a document. But once you've got that, you could retrieve the entire document. It contains all the information that's in the document. And it may be a more suitable way to perform this computation. So an inverted index, for many types of information retrieval tasks, if your data set is reasonably fixed, if your documents are fixed, then you compute something like this inverted index, which is expensive on each document, but is really useful for every single query you do over the document set. And that's exactly what search engines do, is they will crawl the web and then go to quite a lot of effort actually indexing the web. So the size of the index may be larger than the size of data you've got. If you have a really stable collection like a patent database or all legal judgments in a particular jurisdiction, then that's reasonably stable. And so you might go into even more effort indexing every occurrence of every word and their parts of speech and the bigrams and things like that so that you can get more efficient queries over it. So it's not unusual to have the indexing data over a document collection be larger than the document collection itself, if that means that you can get answers faster. And then other ranking methods may make use of information outside the document itself. It's not just the document, it's where was it from, what was it related to. So Google's PageRank looks very heavily at the hyperlinks between documents. And if you're looking for a document, it's not just whether the document includes the words you're looking for, it's whether documents that link to it includes the words you're looking for, and if they include them near the place where the link is. So it's entirely possible to do a query in Google where you look for some words and you get back a document that is about that topic but doesn't mention those words at all. And that'll be because there were lots of pages that did mention the words that pointed into it. You might also have something that, if you had metadata about a document, if it was a document was part of a large collection, then you might have what form this appeared, the source you got it from, the time it appeared. If you have scientific papers, they will refer to other papers, as I was referring with the paper that didn't exist. You have citations, and you can treat those like you do links in Google. You can say, this paper is about that topic, and it's probably important to return it in a query. It's maybe intrinsically interesting because lots and lots of other papers cite it. And that's a common technique used to try and return scientific information. So these are really important, but we're not going to address them directly. We've got this vector space model, which is a way of representing documents, and then there are lots of algorithms to work over that. One in particular is we can compare documents for similarity using the cosine measure of the angle between them, and that one thing you can do with that is use it to drive queries to return documents in an information retrieval system. So that's one use of unstructured data and some things about data retrieval. And we've now got, okay, this is a timing issue. So that's about document retrieval. We had some things that came up there that needed more maths than we had, like looking for collocations or words appearing together, whether it was significant that words appeared together. We've had a little bit of maths here about the cosine angle, but I've kind of stopped when it got more difficult because we want to say, well, what's a good angle, what's close, what's near, and so on. The next few lectures are going to be about particular kinds of mathematical analysis that are useful in the sort of setting I've been talking about. And there will be some automating examples, but it's much more focused now on the maths that you need to do this for the kind of things we've been talking about. There's also about three lectures worth. I'm going to do some of this first one now to get ahead. There are 3 weeks left in term. Normally, on this part of the term, we'd have two more weeks of lectures, and then you have another tutorial which will be going over the coursework you've done. In fact, I'm going to be away at research workshops next Friday and the Friday after, so we're going to have three more lectures on three Tuesdays. So that's next Tuesday, the Tuesday after, and the Tuesday in week 11, which will be about the same time when you're having your final tutorials. So the Friday lectures, the next Friday lecture and the Friday lecture after that will not be happening. You'll notice also that the hand-in date for the assignment is 4 o'clock next Friday afternoon, so conveniently there is not a lecture between 2 and 3 next Friday afternoon, just supposing you did some part of your work during the final afternoon. Of course, you don't need to because it's been out for a week already. I'm sure you've done it. And I think also you may now be in a position to do all of it as well. So statistical analysis of data. So we've had lots about data, big quantities of data, how you might gather it, how you might curate it, that means look after it, keep it up to date, annotate it, a little bit about how you might search through it. But there are lots and lots of other kinds of analysis you can do. And there are at least two common goals for doing analysis. One is that you want to find things inside the data. You want to discover structure, perhaps structure that you weren't already aware of. So you might have experimental data and you want to identify patterns, you look for curves and lines. You might have collections of documents and you want to work out if they cluster around particular topics. So you have some large amount of data, possibly unstructured, possibly semi-structured, and you want to add structure to it, you want to discover structure. Some of the linguistic analyses come under that heading. Doing part of speech tagging automatically on a document, doing syntactic searches, so finding the sentence structure in a document, that's part of analyzing the data. So there you're kind of neutral about what will appear, you just want to see what is the structure in there, or what you maybe name the kind of structure, then the machine will run over it and find it. The other kind of analysis that you might do is you have a specific hypothesis about the data. This pair of words is a collocation. This language contains more sentence variety than that language. Over time, newspaper articles have become more boring, something like that. You have a hypothesis. And then you want to analyze the data to confirm or refute that. It's not unusual if you have a large data set to take a small part of it and to examine that, look for structure, and then you make a hypothesis. You say, I think this structure arises because of that, or in this sample of data, it looks like the following is true. You make a hypothesis, and then use the rest of the data to test that hypothesis. And provided you didn't look at the rest of the data before making your hypothesis, that's a legitimate way to proceed. You don't necessarily have to do new experiments. So you might do analysis to discover structure that you haven't yet found, or you have some specific hypothesis, and you want to confirm or refute it. Statistics, in general, is one of the leading ways to do either of these. So I'm going to talk a little bit about different kinds of statistics. This will be revisiting, for some of you, maths you might have done in high school or elsewhere, or even in the maths or informatics course. Before actually calculating statistics, the only thing I'm going to do in this lecture, though, is talk about different kinds of data scale. And I may not get to the end of this section, depends on the timing. So the type of analysis you're performing depends on why you're doing it, but also on what questions you're asking, but also what kind of data you've got. And one property of data is, and that distinguishes between different kinds of data and the analysis you can do, is whether they're quantitative or qualitative, and then within that we can refine things further. So quantitative information is where you've got numbers. Qualitative information is where kind of you don't, you have something else. And it's a useful distinction, though in fact quantitative data might be, for example, the numbers may be really imprecise or really uncertain, and so yeah, it's numerical, but it's not as firm as all that. And equally qualitative descriptive data might be highly precise. It might be that you have words